from Pacifica. This is Democracy Now! The Bush administration with Saudi Arabia is funding radical Sunni groups tied to al-Qaeda to counter Shia groups backed by Iran. That's the explosive new charge by Seymour Hersh in his New Yorker article called The Redirection. We'll talk with a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. Then an international team of scientists urges the world's nations to act now to prevent climate change from becoming a catastrophe. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration has announced it'll take part in talks with Iran and Syria at two international meetings on Iraq. This would mark the highest level contact with Iranian officials in more than 2 years. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice confirmed the plans during testimony before the Senate Appropriations Committee.
This initial meeting will be followed, perhaps as early as the first half of April, by a ministerial level meeting. I would note that the Iraqi government has invited all of its neighbors, including Syria and Iran, to attend both of these regional meetings. We hope that all governments will seize this opportunity to improve their relations with Iraq and to work for peace and stability in the region.
The announcement comes just weeks after the Pentagon accused Iran of supplying bombs targeting U.S. troops in Iraq. Meanwhile, in Iraq, the Pentagon has admitted to botching a controlled explosion in Ramadi. Flying shrapnel and glass injured 31 people, including several children. The announcement followed an unconfirmed report that more than a dozen children had been killed in a large explosion. In Baghdad, Iraqi police say they recovered at least 30 bodies Tuesday. The Pentagon also announced the deaths of five more U.S. troops. The Bush administration has announced it'll reject any Italian extradition requests for CIA agents indicted in the kidnapping of the Egyptian cleric Abu Omar. 26 Americans have been ordered to stand trial for Omar's abduction on the streets of Milan more than 3 years ago. Omar was flown to Egypt, where he says he was tortured. The International Criminal Court has unveiled the names of suspected war criminals in Sudan who've played a role in the mass killings in Darfur. Named on Tuesday were Sudanese government minister Ahmed Mohamed Haroun and another man accused of being a militia leader. ICC chief prosecutor Luis Moreno Ocampo made the announcement from The Hague.
The attackers did not target any rebel presence. Rather, they target civilian residents based on the rationale that they were supporters of the rebel forces.
The Sudanese government immediately rejected the allegations. This is Sudanese Justice Minister Mohamed Ali Al-Mardi.
We believe that the International Criminal Court has no jurisdiction to try any Sudanese. We maintain our position that the crimes committed in Darfur fall under the jurisdiction of the Sudanese judiciary, which carries out investigations and weighs the evidence and presents it to the independent and impartial court that issues verdicts on them.
Hamas has given new indications it's prepared to reach a negotiated settlement with Israel. On Tuesday, Hamas leader Khaled Meshaal called for an end to the international boycott on the Palestinian government, saying, quote, this will create a political climate that could open a political prospect in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Meanwhile, in the occupied territories, Israel is continuing a military siege of two towns on the West Bank. Three Palestinians were killed earlier today in Israeli raids in the city of Jenin. The violence was followed by street clashes between rock-throwing Palestinian youths and Israeli military vehicles. Meanwhile, Israeli troops have re-entered the city of Nablus. Tens of thousands of residents have been confined to their homes as Israeli troops conducted house-to-house searches. A popular local television station has been off the air since its manager was arrested and its equipment seized on Monday. The station, Sanibel, is the only channel to broadcast out of Nablus. In Egypt, an appeals court has overturned the one-year sentence of a newspaper editor jailed for criticizing President Hosni Mubarak. Ibrahim Issa heads the weekly newspaper Al-Dastur. He had been convicted under an Egyptian law that allows third parties to sue others for defaming government officials. On Tuesday, an appeals judge overturned the jail sentences but upheld the third-party law. Issa criticized that decision after the verdict was read.
I believe that this verdict is one of the signs of the restrictions placed on the press in Egypt. And it opens the doors of hell for Egyptian journalists, because anyone, any citizen, any lawyer, or any member of a political party can bring a court case against any writer or any newspaper about any news item, and it will result in endless harassment of Egyptian journalists, irrespective of whether they are opposition journalists or otherwise.
Back on Capitol Hill, newly appointed Director of National Intelligence Mike McConnell appeared before the Senate Armed Services Committee. Speaking in a hearing on global threats, McConnell singled out Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez.
In Venezuela, Chavez is using his popularity to undercut the opposition and eliminate checks on his authority. He is among the most strident anti-American leaders anywhere in the world and will continue to try to undercut U.S. influence in Latin America and internationally.
McConnell went on to strongly suggest he believes Cuban President Fidel Castro will not live to see next year. His comments came as Castro made his first comments in a live broadcast since he was hospitalized last July. Castro called into the radio show of the Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez and said he's recuperating and gaining energy. In Miami, a Cuban-American married couple was sentenced Tuesday in a case that saw them accused of spying for the Cuban government. Carlos and Elsa Alvarez are both employees at Florida International University. They were sentenced on reduced charges they received as part of a plea deal. Carlos, a professor, was sentenced to 5 years. His wife, Elsa, was given a 3-year term. Both deny the spying charges and say they were trying to open dialogue with Cuba. In Mississippi, a grand jury has decided not to issue an indictment in the 1955 murder of Emmett Till. Till was abducted, beaten, and shot after he allegedly whistled at a white woman named Carolyn Bryant in a store. Carolyn Bryant's husband, Roy Bryant, and his half-brother, J.W. Milam, were tried and acquitted by an all-white jury. The two later confessed to Till's murder, but have since died. Carolyn Bryant was among 12 people facing indictments before the jury's decision. This news comes as the FBI has announced it's reopened about a dozen unresolved murder cases from the civil rights era. The cases are among an estimated 100 ongoing investigations. At the United Nations, a group of leading scientists made a new appeal Tuesday for immediate action on global warming. This is Dr. John Holdren, a member of the Scientific Expert Group on Climate Change and Sustainable Development.
Our specific conclusions are that if the world were to go past the point of an increase above pre-industrial temperatures greater than 2 to 2.5 degrees Celsius, we would be in a regime where the danger of intolerable and unmanageable impacts on human well-being would rise very rapidly. And it's therefore essential, in our view, that the world agree on a target of not exceeding 2 to 2.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial. It's important to understand we're already at about 0.8 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial, and
And finally, former Food and Drug Administration head Lester Crawford has been sentenced to 3 years of supervised probation and a $90,000 fine. Crawford pleaded guilty last year to conflict of interest and false reporting of ownership of stock. Prosecutors say he lied about his ties to several companies regulated by the FDA. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. John Negroponte was sworn in to his new position as Deputy Secretary of State Tuesday at a ceremony attended by President Bush. Negroponte resigned from his post as National Intelligence Director in early January. His career includes stints as ambassador to Iraq after the U.S. invasion, ambassador to Honduras, where he was accused of overseeing the arming of Nicaraguan rebels during the Iran-Contra scandal of the 1980s. In a new explosive article, The New Yorker magazine reports Negroponte's decision to resign as National Intelligence Director was made in part because of the Bush administration's covert actions in the Middle East, which so closely echo Iran-Contra. According to investigative reporter Seymour Hersh, the Bush administration with Saudi Arabia is secretly funding radical Sunni groups, some with ties to al-Qaeda, to counter Shia groups backed by Iran. Moreover, this is being done without any congressional authority or oversight. Hersh also reports the Pentagon has established a special planning group within the office of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to plan a bombing attack on Iran. The new panel's been charged with developing a plan that could be implemented within 24 hours of getting the go-ahead from President Bush. Hirsch also reveals U.S. military and special ops teams have already crossed the border into Iran in pursuit of Iranian operatives. Seymour Hirsch is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for The New Yorker magazine, joining us now from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now, Cy Hirsch.
Good morning.
It's nice to have you back from Egypt.
Yeah, that's right.
Talk about what you have found. Start off with John Negroponte.
Well, I did not talk to him. He did not deny the story. He simply refused to comment when The New Yorker sent a series of questions to his office at the State Department. Essentially, it was simply that there were a couple of reasons that he wanted out of the job that McConnell, you just heard in your opening, took after him. One was that he didn't get along with Cheney very well because he was considered to be too much of a stickler. Or legalistic was another term people used, in terms of agreeing with some of the covert and clandestine operations by the Pentagon. As many now know, the Pentagon has been running operations without any congressional oversight for years. This has been written about on the basis that they were all part of the war, preparing the battlefield, having to do with military affairs, not intelligence. And therefore, since they were not intelligence, they were not there was no reason to abide by legislation reporting covert intelligence operations. They were simply military activities that the president could authorize without Congress. And he disagreed with that. He disagreed, I guess you could say, Negroponte found some of these operations to be risky. And also perhaps illegal, but the one that really upset him the most was the covert operations that we're doing in various places in the Middle East, targeted against the Iranians and also the Shia, with funds used in some part by Bandar. And Amy, I should say one thing to correct what you said in the opening, just to adjust it. It's not as if we're ever going to find any evidence that American money went to any Sunni terrorist jihadist groups in Lebanon, which I allege. There's no direct connection. What there is a flood of American money, none of it approved by Congress, into the government of Lebanon, which is Sunni, the government of Prime Minister Senyora. And they, in turn, funnel it into various, at least three different Sunni jihadist groups.
Now, explain. First of all, you talked about Prince Bandar, this the former ambassador to United States.
22 years here, yes.
Known as Bandar Bush.
Not by me.
So he was the ambassador who sat with the President Bush a few days after the 9/11 attacks as they smoked cigars at the White House.
Well, he's very close. He's very close to Cheney. He was ambassador here for 22 years. He left a few years ago, replaced by a man named Prince Turki, who's a very eminent member of the royal family, was head of intelligence for the Saudi government, also ambassador to London. And Turki came, and Turki quit after less than 2 years on the job because Bandar had a backdoor or a private relationship with too many people in the administration. He was seeing Cheney without telling Turki. He was, you know, he was arranging meetings. So Bandar has a one-on-one relationship, I assume, with the president. I can say firsthand with Cheney, and also very close to certain members of people inside the White House, including Elliot Abrams, the former, who's now I think he's the senior advisor on the Middle East for the National Security Council and a deputy, deputy national security advisor to the president.
So what exactly is the role of Prince Bandar, who's now no longer ambassador, back in Saudi Arabia?
Well, no, exactly. I don't know. We're talking about a world that's very murky and about which nobody wants to talk officially, unofficially even, except for a few people. In other words, I can't go to the Saudi Arabian government and say, give me an explanation of what's going on. That's just, you know, forget it. We try. Bandar left here, and everybody thought his career was over, and including he did too. And he ended up being named National Security Advisor. And lo and behold, in the last 3 or 4 months, he has emerged as a major player for the United States. He's met with the Israelis. What's happened very simply is the president decided sometime in the last 3, 4 months, perhaps earlier, but he's put it into effect in the last 3 or 4 months. He's decided to work with the British, the UK, and the Israelis, and join up. All three of those countries will join up with what we call the moderate Sunni governments, that is Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia, all very strongly Sunni. And those six countries would work together against the Shia and against Iran collectively. In Lebanon, for example, There is a long-standing political, it's been going on for months, really a political standoff between the Sunni government, the Sunni Sunni government, which supports us and we support, and a coalition headed by Hezbollah. The Shia group that we always call a terrorist group, that was a terrorist group, but has now been working pretty much in the last 6 or 7 years domestically and politically inside Lebanon with still great capacity. We're also working against the regime of Bashar Assad in Syria. He's not a Sunni. He's an Alawite, which is also a minority sect that the Sunni world, in the Sunni world, for the Sunni jihadists, if you're not a Sunni and you don't support their particular view, political view of the Quran, you're an infidel. You're expendable. And as an Alawite, Bashar Assad is too. And also, of course, everybody's also targeted Iran. So there's been the article is called The Redirection. That's what they call it in the White House. There's been a sort of a massive shift of attention away from Iraq towards Iran, towards stopping Hezbollah in Lebanon, and towards doing something about Assad.
So who is getting the money in Lebanon right now?
Well, it's money that's flowing in, covert money. A lot of it came when all of this started in Lebanon after the assassination of Rafiq Hariri, whose assassination took place, I think, 2 years ago this month in February of 2005. Immediately, we, the United States and our allies, blamed Syria. There's no empirical evidence Syria did it. That seems to be the prevailing view, but there's just no evidence. There's an awful lot of political assassinations in Lebanon. There's 20 or so in the last 10 years. That's one aspect. And what happened is the Sunni government there became our big ally, and we did everything we could to support it. We flooded, I think we called it the Cedar Revolution. And it was a sense of the Sunni government in opposition to Nasrallah, who we view as a major terrorist threat. And I think I have to tell you, digress a second, to say that I don't know a thing about Bush. I know something about what Cheney thinks, and that is in terms of having some people with firsthand access. And Cheney does believe that the core belief of Cheney is that Iran's going to get a bomb no matter what the intelligence is. As you know, there's not much intelligence supporting the fact that it has a bomb. Iran's going to get a bomb, and once it gets a bomb, its agent, it's brown shirt, and that's the phrase they use at least once or twice inside the White House. It's brown shirts will be Hezbollah. And they have a capacity in America. They have underground facilities, cells here. And when Iran gets the bomb, they will give it to Hezbollah to distribute it, and Washington and New York will be vulnerable. In other words, Cheney sees what's going on now as a threat to the United States directly. He doesn't view this as simply something that's happening in Western Europe or the Middle East. He is protecting America by taking proactive action right now. And so in Lebanon, once Hariri fell and there was a crisis there, we immediately moved to support any group that was against Nasrallah and Hezbollah. And so we've poured a lot of money, illicit money. It was not authorized by Congress. Money went pouring in there. Former retired CIA guys were put in there. Retired people went in there. Other agencies. The funds came. Nobody's quite sure where. There's a lot of pools of black money around. A lot of money. Undoubtedly, some was, I'm told, came from Iraq. That is, there's, as you know, there were hearings the other week that showed $9 billion in Iraqi oil money mysteriously disappeared and was unaccounted for. Some of that money was washed around. There was also a lot of money found after Saddam fell. We found several caches of huge amounts, hundreds of millions and billions of dollars in some cases, of cash. We also found money in various ministries. There's no really accountability, and a lot of it could have ended up in black pools. It's just not clear where the money came from, and it's not supposed to be clear. What you do is you wash the money in, you get it to certain people. The government of Lebanon underwrites its internal security people. And what we do know is in the last few years, or less than that, last year or so, three jihadist groups, three Sunni, Salafi or Wahhabi, these are the religious sects out of Saudi Arabia. And don't forget, 15 of the 19 guys who went into the building in New York, the two towers, were Saudis. And from the extreme religious, almost, they were jihadists from either Salafis or Wahhabis. And we know that the groups now, there are three groups similar in character. According to reports I've read, some of the people in these groups were trained in Afghanistan, closely associated with al-Qaeda. Not everybody. It's a loose network. What you have around the world is these terror groups operated independently of Osama bin Laden, although it's not clear they don't have some ways of communicating through the web or what, we're not sure. But these three groups, 2 years ago, we would have done everything we could in the United States to arrest them and send them to Gitmo, Guantanamo, or some other place. Instead, we're throwing money into the country, into the government, into the internal security apparatus, and the internal security facilities or mechanisms inside Lebanon are underwriting these groups. They, as soon as one group came across the border from Syria, were immediately given material, a place to live, arms, and resupplied. There are three such groups that are operating. And why are they there? Because in case things go bad in Lebanon and we end up in a civil war between Hezbollah and his partners in the coalition and the Sunni government, this is a very tough bunch of guys that can handle, we think, the tough guys inside Hezbollah. It's sort of a matching game. And so, in effect, you sleep with the enemy of your enemy is your friend. Bandar, as I wrote in this article, Bandar has assured us that the Salafi groups in Lebanon are okay. Don't worry about them. I think somebody said, described it to me, he said at one point, I'm a Wahhabi. He's a member of that austere religious sect himself in Saudi Arabia. I can go and pray and then come back from the mosque and sit down and have a business meeting and have a drink. And he said these groups in Lebanon, he told us, are targeted not at America necessarily. They're targeted at Iran, at Hezbollah, at Shias elsewhere, at Syria. That's their prime target, and they're okay. I quote others, including senior people from Saudi Arabia, saying, this is really nutty because these people are not controllable. So that's where we are in that situation. It's complicated. It's very cynical in a way. And what you have is a major sort of redirection. I had one military friend describe it as failing forward, talking about the failures in Iraq driving this policy. And you got it, kid.
And the U.S. is also funding, supporting, training the Sunni police in Iraq.
Well,
the Shia police in Iraq.
No, here's the wonderful irony of it, of course, is that after 9/11, after we invaded Iraq, the neoconservatives in Washington wanted nothing to do with the Ba'athist Party. That's Saddam's party. Most of them were Sunnis. Disbanded the Ba'athist Party, disbanded the military. A lot of Sunnis, a lot of Shia in the military, too, of course. Threw in our weight with the Shia. Within months, the American intelligence community was raising a lot of questions internally. I was talking to people about this by the late spring of 2003. They were trying to tell the White House, you guys are making a big mistake because Iran's the big winner of this war, particularly when we began to see signs of the insurgency. And the Shia are going to support Iran. The Shia are going to go with the Shia of Iran over you. In the neocon mantra, there had been a war between Iran and Iraq for 8 years during the 1980s, a very, very devastating war. Thousands killed in any one set-piece battle. They would just rush each other. And the assumption of the neoconservatives was that the Iraqi Shiites, having fought the Iranian Shiites for so long and so brutally, would be loyal to Iraq. Well, it turned out the Shiite, particularly when the occupation began and the American troops began, like all occupiers, became hated. I don't think there was much we could do. We certainly, our activities and the bombing and the violence didn't help. But no matter how we behave, occupiers historically are always hated. And so once that happened, and we became the Americans became essentially the 200 octane fuel that drove the resistance. Once that began, the Shiite immediately began to work with the Iranians much more. And all of this was ignored by the White House for years because it didn't fit in with their preconceptions.
We're talking to Seymour Hersh, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for The New Yorker magazine. Don't go away. When we come back from our break, we're going to ask him about this planning group within the Joint Chiefs of Staff that is planning to attack Iran. And he says once it gets the word, it could happen within 24 hours. Stay with us.
Harbor. بازم بیا عشقو بیارش، بده هر یاری رو دست نگارش. بهار بازم بیا عشقو بیارش، بده هر یاری رو دست نگارش. بازم بیا عشقو بیارش، بده هر یاری رو دست نگارش. بهار بازم بیا عشقو بیارش، بده هر یاری رو دست نگارش. بهار بازم بیا عشقو بیارش، بده هر یاری رو دست نگارش. بهار بازم بیا عشقو بیارش، بده هر یاری رو دست نگارش.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting over 500 stations around the country on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM, college and community stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Seymour Hersh is our guest, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for The New Yorker magazine. He has an explosive new piece called The Redirection. Before we go to the planning group that is ready to attack Iran within the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I want to ask you about this group of players you've laid out, Cy. You're talking about Elliot Abrams, about Prince Bandar, and their connections to 20 years ago to the Iran-Contra scandal. Explain.
Well, it's interesting. One of my favorite paragraphs in the story, it's unsourced, but it describes a meeting within the last 2 years that Elliot Abrams called. Elliot Abrams, as some may remember, was a key player. He was in the Reagan White House in the National Security Council. And what happened is 20-some-odd years ago, Ronald Reagan wanted very much to stop what he saw as the revolutionary government of Nicaragua, the Sandinista government. He thought they were pro-communist. It's a little bit like the Chavez issue today. And the CIA began supporting a group of opposition people known as the Contras, a pretty violent bunch of people. Congress authorized an amendment called the Bolin Amendment. A congressman just, they passed an amendment saying no money for the Contras. So instead of adhering to that, the government then, if you remember the name Ollie North and the National Security Advisor John Poindexter, set up a sort of a Rube Goldberg scheme to sell arms through Israel to Iran. The Iranians were our bitter enemies at that time. We were only 7 years from the overthrow of the Shah and the capture of our embassy people. If you remember, they were kept for more than a year. And the idea was to generate profits that would, the sale would generate a lot of profits that would be used to fund the Contras. Well, this, of course, blew up in everybody's face. There were sort of inconclusive hearings in the Senate. A few people were charged. I don't remember. Nothing much came out of it. They never got to the bottom of it. Nobody wanted to go after Reagan. It was 87, et cetera, whatever happened. So 2 years ago, Abrams, who's still now in the government, even more important than ever, very conservative, Elliot Abrams, pro-Israel, et cetera, he convened a meeting of all of those people in the Bush administration who had been connected to Iran-Contra. It was like a reunion, somebody said to me. And they did a lessons learned. What was the good thing? Well, the good thing is you could do things outside of Congress who would stop you. Those bad guys in Congress, you could do things for the good of the nation. That was the plus. The negatives were pretty extreme because, of course, it got blown. Let's see. The negatives included you don't trust your friends. You don't trust the uniformed military. You don't trust the CIA. And you don't let it be run by the NSC, by somebody like Poindexter. You move it into the vice president's office, Cheney's office. I gather that was the time they began thinking about this possibility. And obviously, they were talking to Bandar all along, as I say, the former ambassador. He later became, when he left, he became the National Security Advisor of Saudi Arabia, sort of a surprise job, a new job they set up for him. And I think at that point, some point a long time ago, they began thinking about doing what they're doing now, using Saudi money and some of the American funds from wherever they get it, whether Iraq or other pools. There's a lot of black pools of money around. Undeclared pools, using American and Saudi money without going to Congress for anything to fund the kind of operations they want to fund, as I was describing, against Hezbollah, against et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so this is the genesis, if you will, history. You know, of course, I've never known an American government to learn from history. And once again, they haven't. They've now done another Rube Goldberg scheme here. I just don't know if Congress... I can assure you that Congress knows very little about what's going on now in Iran. They're not being briefed. They know nothing about the money going in there. At least I've been told by members who are in a position to know. There's been no real findings.
So will they hold hearings?
Oh, will anybody do anything? I don't know. You know, you pump out this stuff. I started writing about Iran, I think, almost a year ago about covert operations in Iran. And for the longest time, I felt a little bit like Chicken Little. You know, they got running around saying, the sky is falling. Well, now a lot of people are very interested in Iran. But still, I haven't seen, as you know, there's a vibrant, in Europe, this story like I write is huge, and this story is huge around the world. But it's hard to, you know, the major newspapers have troubles because... I don't think it's because they don't want to burn the story. They can't find people that will verify it for them because this is such inside stuff, I guess.
Seymour Hersh, can you talk about the planning group within the Joint Chiefs of Staff?
That is nothing new, really. It's just the same old story. It's all contingency planning. There's been no execute order. In other words, there's no order to stop bomb Iran. The president has now... A lot of the planning was done at a place in Virginia, a very secret Joint Staff facility where the services would get together and discuss what to hit. And they moved it within the last few months. They've set up a special cell inside the Joint Chiefs, very secret. That's sort of normal. Everything's secret in there. And they've been giving a number of at least two new developments have taken place. One is the president or the White House has asked for a bombing raid that can be put on within 24 hours. What can we hit if the president wakes up one morning and scratches something and says, I want to go? What can you do in the next 24 hours? They've done that, or they are doing that. The other significant change is the debate all along about bombing internally, with the Air Force being very much for it and a lot of the other services being very much against it. There's been tremendous dissension about this in the Joint Chiefs. The initial targeting was what they call counterproliferation. That is against the Iranian nuclear targets. As you know, Iran is a member of the nonproliferation regime and has released and made public all of its facilities, at least all it's declared many facilities, perhaps not all, but they say it's all. To the International Atomic Energy Agency. So using what we know from the IAEA, we've targeted a lot of things that we would destroy in case of a major assault. There's also been something called regime change targeting. The wonderful word they use inside this in the system is decapitation. You go after leadership nodules. You hit the leaders, where they live, where they work, and you get rid of the top layer of the mullahs running the government, and presumably in the fantasy land that exists among the neocons, the people then rush and take over, and they set up a democratic Iran that's secular and pro-American. But what's happened in the last month or two in the wake of the president's new campaign, that's very clear since January 10th, I think, when he made a speech, we've seen an absolute drumbeat of allegations that Iran is involved in operations directly against American and responsible for killing Americans. You know, this stuff about the bombs that they give. And I think it's Article 51 of the UN. I see it. Some of my friends see this as a legal argument the president's making. Under the UN articles, you have a right of self-defense. And if some country is killing your troops or acting against them, you can attack them. That seems to be one of the basis for why the president is saying what he's saying. The Iranians are all over Iraq. They've been all over Iraq. There's thousands inside Iraq at any time. They were there very early, walking around in black suits, white shirts with no ties, black shoes, white socks. They're very clear they're not hiding themselves. Many did humanitarian things and other social things, really. Iran has a strong presence in Iran has a strong presence in Iraq and has all along. There's no evidence they're shooting guns. They're certainly helping to supply them, et cetera, which, of course, makes sense for Iran. Why shouldn't they? The longer we are stalemated in Iraq, the better it is for them. They're the winners of this war. So in any case, the president then asked for a new wave of targeting to take place, that is targeting against terrorism targets inside Iran. I'm not sure what they're talking about, maybe base camps, et cetera. And we've also, since last summer, dramatically increased cross-border operations, very aggressive activities, sometimes hot pursuit of what we claim are Iranians. We're attacking the border more, going across more and more. There's some people who think we could be looking for some sort of a response by Iran that would cause us bellites so that we can do some actual physical assault with some justification. It's not clear. I'm not clear why we're being more aggressive. It seems, I guess common sense would tell you maybe we are looking for some response, but the Iranians have not done it.
And Iran has just accused the United States of attacking and killing 11 Iranian soldiers.
Well, this is part of the game. And don't forget, as I wrote, you know, I hate to say it, but as I wrote a year ago, we've been deeply involved with Azeris and Baluchis and Iranian Kurds in terror activities inside the country. I mean, this is, and well, of course, the Israelis have been involved in a lot of that through Kurdistan. So this has been going on for a year. Iran's been having sort of a series of backdoor fights, the Iranian government, because they have a significant minority population. Not everybody there is a Persian. There's some, if you add up the Azeris and Baluchis and Kurds, you're really 30-something, maybe even 40% of the country.
Seymour Hersh, Dick Cheney went to Saudi Arabia in November. Now, well, he went to Asia and then showed up suddenly, a surprise visit both to Pakistan and Afghanistan, and supposedly there was a attempted assassination, a bombing outside the base where he was. What is Cheney doing right now?
Oh, you know, how do I know?
You seem to know a lot about a lot of things,
no,
especially around Dick Cheney.
No, I just know. Well, you know, I think he's the horse. I don't think there's always this, every 2 weeks there's a story in some newspapers saying he's lost power. I don't think so. I think he still runs things. I think if, you know, if Rice is going to do anything, attend some meeting, some ambassadorial minister-level meeting, it's only done with Cheney's approval. But, of course, that's just my heuristic thought.
And the latest news yesterday of the U.S. will be involved in direct negotiations with Iran and Syria?
Our definition of negotiations with Iran are very interesting. Our definition of a negotiating offer with Iran, remember there was a big flurry last year where we announced we would sit down at the table with Iran? Well, here's the way we put it. The issue for us is Iran is continuing to do nuclear research, and presumably, whether or not they have a bomb, they're learning the techniques of making a weapon, and this is probably absolutely accurate. That's what they are learning. They're increasing the number of centrifuges they're running, et cetera, albeit with a lot of problems, and they're nowhere down near a weapon. But that's they're going for that process. So our position is that we will negotiate with Iran on that issue. On what they're doing in terms of nuclear development, only after they stop all nuclear development. So our bargaining position is we will not negotiate with you about what you're doing in terms of the nuclear development until you stop it. I mean, it is a total non-starter. And so I just am very skeptical about anything that's going to come out of any ministerial or subsequent meeting with the Iranians and the Syrians. I don't think the President of the United States and the Vice President want to leave office with things as they are right now.
You have always said you're afraid of President Bush as a lame duck president. Do you seriously think, I know you've been writing about it for a year in the New Yorker magazine, that he will attack Iran? Or do you see Israel attacking Iran?
No, Israel would never attack Iran. The best they could do is fire some missiles from the Indian Ocean. They have submarines with cruise missiles. No, that's not nearly enough. What's a small attack? A major attack, if you're going to do one, have to come from the Americans. And Cheney has said internally he'll never let the Israelis do it. It's much better if we do it. But that I feel reasonably rational, I can say, with some confidence. I can't say anything at all about what the president will or will not do. There are people inside the military. There's two aircraft carrier groups in the region right now. One's inside the Straits of Hormuz, which is that narrow straits where all of the oil passes through, going from the Middle East to Asia. And it's such a narrow channel that the U.S. Navy never even had a carrier go into the Straits of Hormuz because they're accompanied by five or six ships, destroyers, et cetera, and they don't have much maneuverability. They're very vulnerable to attack. And I'm told by people that there will be two more carriers sent this spring to relieve the two ships' fleets that are there now. And they will all be kept there for a little while, one off Oman, one in what they call the North Arabian Sea, Nas, one in the Indian Ocean, and one in the Straits of Hormuz. And once those four groups are out there, you're talking about an enormous amount of firepower. And it's at that point some people inside the military are worried about what the president might or might not do. I don't think he's going to do anything next year. It's an election year. And he's got to spend, you know, he's not an old man. He doesn't want to be hated by the Republican Party all of the rest of his life. He's damaging it enough now, but in 08, he's got to be careful. He's got to give the Republicans a shot at the presidency. And the way he's carrying on right now, he's helping the Democrats. So if he does it, it'll be this year. And, you know, people worry about spring. And if he is in a position where he can authorize something on short notice, and you could with carriers all over the place, there's an awful lot of planes. The carrier squadrons have destroyers with cruise missiles that can fire. You can hit a lot of things in Iran if you want. The Iranians, I should tell you, are absolutely preparing for the worst. They've been digging holes. They've been digging what they call bunkers for their leadership, survival bunkers, and not in Tehran, outside. We know what they're digging. They're going to move the leadership to underground facilities. The Russians did the same thing during the Cold War, and we, of course, have the same thing, underground bunkers to protect our leaders. They're reinforcing a lot of buildings. They've moved most of the sensitive nuclear stuff, I think, out of the buildings where we think they are, into probably into Tehran, in the very heavily, densely populated areas. So if we're going to bomb nuclear facilities, so we're going to have to take a chance of an awful lot of collateral damage. And there's also the possibility, this is always raised, that all of this is just some big send-up, that people like me are being used, stories are planted, that this is all part of a propaganda operation by the White House to put pressure on Iran. The only argument against that is, of course, is it's not going to work, and the Iranians will never back off.
Seymour Hersh, what about the report in the Times of London that says 5 or 6 U.S. generals will resign if the U.S. attacks Iran?
What paper was that? That's of interest to me. Was it The Telegraph?
I think it was The Times of London.
Well, you know, it depends. The Telegraph, I always think, have tremendous intelligence about the Americans. It's a conservative paper there that does a great job. A year ago, I wrote that officers are willing to resign inside, high-level officers inside the Joint Chiefs, on the basis of the fact that the White House refused to take out the nuclear option and the plans that were going on. And the military won that battle. The president agreed to a new plan that did not include a nuclear option. And so that didn't happen. So the only thing I know is that there is a precedent for it. When you talk about resignations in the Joint Chiefs, what you're really talking about are not public resignations. You're talking about early retirements. People just say, I'm out of here. Nobody goes public. They just don't do that in the middle of a war because it's just not seen as a senior officer as something you want to do to your troops on the ground. You don't do something to walk away from them. So it would be, my understanding is, if they did leave, it would be quiet.
Seymour Hersh, I want to thank you very much for being with us.
No sweat.
Thank you. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with The New Yorker magazine. His latest piece that has caused such a stir, the explosive findings in this, called The Redirection. Is the administration's new policy benefiting our enemies in the war on terrorism? This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, global warming. Stay with us.
Whoa. Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Whoa, mercy, mercy me. All things and what they used to be long oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury. Oh, oh, mercy, mercy me. All things and what they used to be long. Radiation underground and in the sky. Animals and birds who live nearby are nice. Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things and what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more we use from man? Can't you stand? I'm not.
Marvin Gaye here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, the issue of global warming has been in the news a lot recently. Just yesterday, an international team of scientists declared the global warming debate is over. They presented a detailed report to the United Nations to combat global climate change. The panel recommended pouring billions more dollars into research and development of cleaner energy resources and stated failure to act will produce turbulent 21st century weather extremes, as well as spread drought and disease, expand oceans, displace coastal populations. The report, the results of a two-year study, was compiled by an 18-member group of scientists representing 11 nations. It comes just weeks after the world's leading body of climate scientists, the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Environmental Climate Change, concluded global warming is most likely caused by human activity and may be impossible to stop. Also yesterday, a group of developing nations known as the Group of 77 said wealthy countries must take responsibility for causing climate change instead of laying the blame on others. Munir Akram, Pakistan's UN ambassador and chair of the Group of 77, said though emissions of greenhouse gases and other pollutants are increasing in booming Asian countries like China and India, quote, most of the environmental degradation has historically been caused by the industrial world. Francesca Grifo and Brenda Aguirre-Zal join us now. Francesca is the head of the Union of Concerned Scientists Scientific Integrity Program. Brenda's climate scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Your response to this latest news, Francesca?
Well, I think it's consistent with a lot of the things that we found with our survey of climate scientists in the various agencies. I mean, they've been thinking about this issue and talking about this issue for a very long time. And it's finally, it feels like the whole rest of the world is catching up and now on the same page with us.
Talk about what you found. I mean, this is a very interesting report that you did of federal scientists in the United States.
We talked to climate scientists across several agencies. We did personal interviews together with our collaborators at the Government Accountability Project. And what we found was that there were significant barriers to their ability to communicate the science. That means that if they're not able to meet with the media to get that science out, that there's very important information that the American people are not hearing about climate change science.
But talk about the percentages. It's quite something of scientists who feel that their reports have been suppressed, that they can't do the kind of research they want to do, that when they do the research, they're not allowed to talk about it.
There's a number of issues here. I mean, one example for press releases. A scientist has an interesting set of results. They want to put that into a press release. They want to share that information, and they're delayed. It takes a long time to get that out. Or the title of the press release is dramatically changed to make it something that isn't interesting and exciting to the public, and obviously it doesn't get covered. But what we found overall is that large numbers of scientists, 43% of those that we surveyed, for example, came back and said, you know, I'm being asked to change my research. I'm being asked to do things like eliminate climate change and global warming, those words. I'm having trouble getting this stuff into peer-reviewed journals. I'm having trouble getting the word out.
And who's doing it?
Well, I think it's hard to say exactly who's doing it because we're not there, but we do have documents that we were able to obtain through Freedom of Information Act requests, and what's happening are the public affairs officers are actually interfering. In one case, in order to not have a scientist do an interview alone, a public affairs officer flew from Washington all the way to Hawaii to be there at the interview to hear what was being said. And the other thing they do is ahead of these interviews, scientists have to turn in questions that, you know, are going to be asked and what their answers are going to be. And of course, these are used to determine whether or not they're allowed to do the interview.
Words like global warming vacuumed off of websites?
Yes, we've seen that. But, you know, global warming and climate change, we've seen difficulties with the minders, as I said, coming along. I mean, just a whole slew of different issues. And we've seen this not just with climate change, I should say, but with a whole variety of other issues. For example, we had surveyed a large number of scientists across many federal agencies, and we had 699 federal scientists. I mean, this is the brain trust of our federal science coming back to us and saying that they feared retaliation for talking about the missions of their agencies.
What kind of retaliation?
Well, it comes in very different forms. I mean, it comes in not being allowed to go to conferences, not being allowed to publish, being told not to say certain things. I mean, a whole variety of things.
You've also done a very interesting major study on ExxonMobil. smoke, mirrors, and hot air. How ExxonMobil uses big tobacco's tactics to manufacture uncertainty on climate science. Brenda Ecorzo, can you talk about this?
Yes, this report shined the spotlight on the very few that would intentionally misrepresent the good science that our federal scientists are doing, international researchers around the world on global warming, and combined with perhaps muzzling some of the ability of our federal scientists to talk to the public, this left the public understandably confused for years about global warming. So this report gathered information that was known, but shed a very bright spotlight on those so that the world could know that this is happening in the United States. In particular, and many people around the world are wondering, why does the United States perhaps not act as one of the largest emitters of heat-trapping emissions? Why are we not acting to solve this problem? And once people understand that the public has been left confused and kept from the very good science that is out there, that makes sense. And so now that is starting to shed away, and legislatures, state legislatures, are starting to enact global warming solutions around the nation as the information comes out.
Talk about the power of ExxonMobil. This isn't just any company, the largest publicly traded company in the world, one of the most powerful corporations in the world. How exactly does it infiltrate scientific circles and prevent information from getting out?
Well, what we have is a money trail that we can see that there are money that's being sent to organizations that those organizations hire people who we see in front of the media intentionally misrepresenting the science, cherry-picking data, and so on. And so we know that ExxonMobil in the past has contributed money to these organizations who have well-known spokespeople who misrepresent the science.
Like.
Now, when you think about ExxonMobil's profits, we're talking just a day of profit in 1 year. It's not much money for them to do this little sideshow of misrepresentation. They also spend a lot of money in good science at Stanford, at MIT, at other places around the world where they do promote that we are trying to look for ways to capture and sequester carbon dioxide. But I think people might not have been aware of that very small trickle of money that had a very big impact because the media is a very, that's what most people perhaps get their information from.
Can you talk about the organizations that they support, the think tanks that put out reports that people don't realize where the money is coming from, so they think of them as independent organizations
right.
putting out that information, and the spokespeople that perhaps should be identified
right.
ultimately as speaking for or funded by ExxonMobil.
That's right. In the larger organizations, you cannot draw it directly from the money that goes into that organization to that particular spokesperson. That gets blurry. But there are some institutes out there that really, literally, it's $50,000 to a spokesperson who's working out of his basement, and ExxonMobil is the single funder. And what there are these groups that have interesting names, and it sounds like it's an echo chamber of many, many people, but when you look, and the report shows that it's the same spokespeople that are associated with the very maybe 10 or 15 organizations, and it looks like an echo chamber of doubt about global warming and some of the science. And so many of the scientists are spent defending their own good work, and that is a problem for the public, I think.
So you say the strategies are to manufacture uncertainty by raising doubts about even the most indisputable scientific
That's
evidence.
Right. That's
like,
right. For example, some contrarians will say that the Earth has not warmed over the past decade or so, and the reality is that 11 of the last 12 of the 12 hottest years since 1850, when we have sufficient records worldwide, are the hottest on record. We are on an upward trajectory, and to get on media and say that this is not true, it's simply unacceptable.
Promoting scientific spokespeople,
yes.
another of the studies, meaning.
Essentially, some people are literally working out of their basements, and their only tax return is showing money that's directly
like
from ExxonMobil. I have to admit, I can't. All these names—they sound so nebulous and so wonderful that I, in that they have home and heartland, or it's things in, competitive in their names that I can't remember exactly the one that had the 50,000. But some are larger organizations that have legitimate analysis and so on. But the spokespeople who are talking about global warming, we know, are intentionally misrepresenting it. And Exxon funds these groups.
Attempting to shift the focus.
Yes, it's a distraction. And it all leads to inaction on global warming, I think. Because if people aren't, I've seen America, when we've been faced by problems in the past, and once we're aware of them, we can unleash innovation and our incredible resources to solve major problems that we have in the past in our history. And this is one of the big crises that we have to face urgently now. And the fact that the American public has been kept in the dark a little bit is disturbing.
I wanted to ask you about the latest headline. The governors of Arizona, California,
yes,
New Mexico, Oregon, and Washington agreeing to work together to reduce greenhouse gases. How will they do this?
It's similar to what the Northeast states started leading the way. The 10 Northeast states and Mid-Atlantic states, it's a regional cap and trade program where you look at ways to say, as a state or a region, we do not want to emit global warming pollution above a certain level. And this was, and we can trade among each other. This was successfully used to solve the acid rain problem in the past. And that was a very successful program that cost much less than the initial designers thought. And it's an American idea, cap and trade, and international associations, international governments are following this to solve global warming. And America has not quite signed on yet, but the states are leading the way to look at regional cap and trade to reduce global warming pollution.
Brenda Ecuarzel, the Oscars. Vice President Gore didn't exactly win the Oscar, but it's based on his speech, An Inconvenient Truth. That won the Oscar. Do you feel that there is a turning point right now, or do you feel there'll be a huge backlash from these powerful corporations?
Oh, to me. Sorry,
sorry, Francesca.
No, that's okay. No. I think it's really powerful that people are getting to hear about this in a whole variety of different venues. I mean, it's so important when we do have federal scientists being muzzled, when we do have them not able to really speak out in the ways that they are trained and able to do, to have a whole different, you know, aspect of it being on the Oscars. I mean, I thought it was fabulous that, and I thought it was fabulous that, Al Gore was able to get up there and speak, and that there was this support amongst that community in general for this issue and for the fact that it's time to act. We've been in the dark a long time. We've had various forces that Brenda talked about and that, you know, we've talked about and found with our report that have been keeping Americans from really taking action. And now's the time. I feel like, you know, the tide is really turning.
What do you think is the most important single thing that could happen right now in this last 10 seconds? What do you feel has to be done, Brenda?
I think that the states are acting because there's an absence of national leadership.
And in the new Congress?
I think the new Congress is starting to take meaningful action, looking at bills, and the question remains whether the executive branch will sign on to these bills that are being considered in Congress, which are very bold and will help solve global warming problem. So we need national leadership as well as state and congressional action.
I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Francesca Grifo is head of the Union of Concerned Scientists Scientific Integrity Program. Brenda Ecuarzel is climate scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And that does it for our broadcast, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabio Kadush, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yuba Rich, and Aramate, Jen Yutz, Anurata Bhagwati, and Megan Whitney, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, Miguel Noguera, our engineers. Our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah.